Welcome to the deep dive. Our mission today is really to cut through all the noise, give you a granular, actionable breakdown of the highest stakes policy shifts happening right now in Washington. This is the Federal News Update for Tuesday, September 30th, 2025.
And that date, September 30th, it's really critical here. I'm Sam Kennedy. This report covers a, well, frankly, frantic 48-hour period, the last 2 days before the fiscal year runs out, starting back on the morning of September 29th. And the sheer speed, the velocity of policy shifts in just these 2 days, it's not just high, it feels like it's designed to be transformative.
And I'm Alex Johnson. We're going to guide you through this really intricate stack of sources we've got. Our analysis frames this moment as one of, let's call it profound strategic dissonance. It's quite a term, but it fits, doesn't it?
It really does. Because if you look at the landscape, you've got the executive branch operating with exceptional speed, almost reckless, you could say.
Yeah, reckless speed. Yeah. Using unilateral power, you know, executive orders, proclamations, these agency directives to push through really transformative change. And that's across the board. Foreign policy, domestic regulations, even a basic structure of how government administration works.
And that aggressive speed, it's only really possible because of the flip side.
Yeah.
The legislative branch. Congress is just, well, completely mired in paralysis.
It's called deadlock.
Exactly. Deadlocked over fundamental funding decisions.
Yeah.
And their inability to act, it creates this power vacuum, you see.
Right.
Which the executive is, frankly, actively exploiting. They're essentially weaponizing Congress's inaction to push forward an agenda that, you know, normally would take years of negotiation.
Years, right. And the ultimate referee in all this, naturally, is the judicial branch, sitting above the fray, supposedly. Mm-hmm. We've got rulings coming down just this week that show the courts are serving as the critical and sometimes contradictory arbiter on these really foundational constitutional questions, separation of powers stuff.
Mm-hmm. Specifically, the power of the purse versus this idea of executive impoundment, withholding funds.
It's a major clash. So what we promise you today is a detailed, deep breakdown. Every major policy shift, every bureaucratic maneuver, every constitutional showdown from this really intense 48-hour window.
Okay, let's start with the biggest foreign policy move, because this one, it seemed to redefine global priorities almost instantly. On September 29th, the White House, standing alongside Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, unveiled this comprehensive 20-point peace plan designed to end the, nearly two-year war in Gaza now.
Yeah, nearly 2 years. And this wasn't some soft diplomatic opening, was it? It felt more like a firm declaration of terms.
That's the key distinction, exactly. This plan was presented as a really high-stakes, kind of take-it-or-leave-it framework, the core of the immediate terms.
Yeah.
An immediate, unconditional cessation of hostilities the moment it's accepted. Battle lines frozen right where they are.
So it basically locks in the current military reality as the starting point for any peace process.
Precisely. And then the most immediate and probably most agonizing detail is the hostage and prisoner exchange. It's set on a very, very strict timeline.
Strict how?
Hamas has to return all hostages alive and tragically deceased within the first 72 hours of the plan being accepted.
72 hours? That's incredibly fast.
It is. And once that clock runs out, assuming the hostages are accounted for, Israel then commits to releasing 250 prisoners who are currently serving life sentences, plus another 1,700 Gazans who've been detained since the attacks back on October 7th, 2023.
The level of specificity is just startling here. It even covers the repatriation of remains, doesn't it?
It does. The plan lays out a specific and, let's be honest, quite macabre exchange ratio.
Yeah.
15 deceased Gazan individuals will be released for every one deceased Israeli hostage return.
15 to 1. That ratio, it sets a really tangible high value on getting every single Israeli body back. It underlines the non-negotiable feel of this whole repatriation aspect.
But the truly transformative piece of this proposal, I think, is what it means for the future of Hamas itself.
Right. What does the plan say there?
It demands the complete, verifiable disarmament of the organization and its formal renunciation of any role in governing Gaza. Not now, not ever.
Complete removal from power.
Exactly. And the administration offers a structured way to comply. It's not just a demand with no path forward.
Okay, so how does that compliance actually work? What's the structure?
Well, they've formalized this system that basically amounts to conditional amnesty. Members who decommission their weapons, commit to living peacefully, they're offered amnesty. But for those who are unwilling to comply, won't disarm, won't renounce the movement, the plan offers safe passage. An exile program, essentially, to designated receiving countries.
So it's a complete dismantling strategy operationally and politically. Either integrate peacefully or leave.
That's the choice presented. And then post-conflict governance. This is also novel. It's designed to bypass the traditional political players.
Like the Palestinian Authority.
Specifically, the Palestinian Authority, which the administration seems to view as incapable of handling immediate, transparent reconstruction. Instead, the plan proposes a temporary, apolitical Palestinian technocratic committee. Their job, manage civil administration.
Okay, apolitical technocrats. But supervised by whom? This is where the personalized diplomacy really kicks in, right? The part that drew immediate criticism.
Exactly. This new committee won't just operate freely. It's to be supervised by a totally unprecedented international body. They're calling it the Board of Peace.
The Board of Peace. And the sources confirm President Trump intends to personally chair this board.
That's right. Personally chair it, alongside other globally influential figures. Former British Prime Minister Tony Blair was mentioned specifically.
Wow. Okay, that move changes the entire dynamic, doesn't it? It shifts the center of gravity for accountability for reconstruction funding.
Completely. Away from established multilateral organizations, the UN, the EU, and places it directly under the purview of this personalized, almost CEO-style board, chaired by the sitting U.S. president.
And the sources indicated there's an economic plan tied to this.
Yes, the accompanying Trump economic development plan. It's apparently contingent on this structure, linking direct aid and reconstruction funds explicitly to this executive-controlled board.
But getting this kind of proposal off the ground, securing broad consensus, that didn't just happen by accident. We need to talk about the diplomatic groundwork laid just before this.
Absolutely crucial. The precursor that provided the necessary regional buy-in. Just before the peace plan was announced, the administration managed to secure a really significant diplomatic win. An apology from Prime Minister Netanyahu to his Qatari counterpart.
An apology? Over what?
It was needed because of that September 9th Israeli missile strike, the one that tragically killed a Qatari serviceman. The White House apparently helped broker this expression of deep regret. That was the term Qatar accepted as an apology. And it immediately mended that rift.
So that single diplomatic act was key to getting the regional players back on the same page, reestablishing a unified front.
Absolutely. Consolidating their support before dropping the peace plan. And the immediate international reaction just underscores how successful that coalition building was.
Who endorsed it?
Swift. Broad endorsement from an extraordinary coalition. Key Arab and Islamic nations, Saudi Arabia, UAE, Qatar, Egypt, Jordan. Even Indonesia, Pakistan, Turkey.
Wow, that's a wide net.
Huge. They issued a joint statement welcoming the proposal. And alongside them, major Western allies. The UK, France, Germany.
So by lining up that powerful consensus first.
They effectively isolated Hamas politically. This plan isn't really a starting point for negotiation. It's more like an ultimatum backed by this powerful global and regional alignment that Hamas, on its own, really can't resist.
Okay, so while the world is processing that massive foreign policy shift, the policy machine back home certainly didn't stop.
Not even close. Domestically, the executive branch seemed to use the cover of that Gaza headline to execute a massive unilateral overhaul of U.S. immigration and labor policy, sharply focused on high-skilled labor and, well, capital.
Let's start with the H-1B changes. This proclamation, it's a big one.
Huge. It introduced a mandatory, non-refundable, get this, $100,000 payment for all new H-1B petitions.
$100,000 per petition.
Per petition. Filed for workers who are outside the U.S. This fee increase, there's just no precedent for it in U.S. immigration history. Nothing close.
And the administration's justification.
Officially curbing alleged systemic abuse of the H-1B program. Mm-hmm. And specifically, protecting American wages by making it economically unviable to sponsor workers at lower wage levels.
But the practical implications,
yeah,
they go much further than just the fee, right?
Yeah. The proclamation doesn't stop there. It actually directs federal agencies to completely overhaul the existing visa lottery system.
Overhaul how?
It mandates a shift away from the current random selection. Moves towards a system that explicitly prioritizes higher paid, higher skilled applicants. The clear goal is filtering based on an income floor, not just skills alone.
So what does that $100,000 charge actually do to the U.S. economy? Who pays it?
Well, the really big tech firms, the ones heavily reliant on H-1Bs, they'll probably absorb the cost. It's painful, but manageable for them. But think about smaller startups, specialized niche firms, research institutions. They might depend on just a few highly skilled foreign employees, but they don't have those kinds of capital reserves. It completely locks them out.
So it acts like a massive selective innovation tax, essentially.
That's a good way to put it, an innovation tax. And this leads directly to the concern that economists and investors raised immediately, a potential brain drain.
Meaning skilled workers just go elsewhere.
Exactly.
Yeah.
If workers can move to, say, Canada, which offers much faster and cheaper paths to residency for skilled labor, why wouldn't they? Plus, it incentivizes U.S. companies to simply offshore their high-skilled R&D operations. Avoid paying that $100,000 regulatory hurdle for every employee they want to bring in.
And this is already facing legal challenges.
Oh, absolutely. It's setting the stage for major legal battles, questioning the president's authority to impose such a massive fee without clear congressional appropriation or specific legal authorization.
Okay, so you have this huge new cost barrier for skilled workers coming in. But then you couple that with the new gold card program.
Right. Established via executive order during this exact same period. And this shows the other side of the coin, the administration's core philosophy crystallizing.
What is the gold card?
It's an expedited pathway to an immigrant visa, a green card, basically. But for those with significant capital.
Significant capital meaning?
The requirement for this fast track is a non-refundable $1 million gift to the U.S. Department of Commerce.
A gift. Not an investment.
A gift, non-refundable. And if that gift is made by a corporation on behalf of the individual, which you can imagine happening for attracting high net worth investors,
Okay. The
fee jumps to $2 million.
So how is this different from existing investor visas like the EB-5 program?
It's fundamentally different because EB-5 involves an investment that is supposed to create jobs and can eventually be returned. This is an outright non-refundable payment directly to the Treasury. A gift.
So if we put these two massive policies together, the six-figure tax on high-skilled labor coming from abroad and the seven-figure fee for expedited residency for the wealthy, the conclusion seems pretty unavoidable.
Yeah, the administration is fundamentally reorienting U.S. residency towards this sort of bifurcated model. It explicitly values capital over skills alone, at least in terms of ease of entry.
It feels like the U.S. is essentially monetizing residency in a very, very explicit way.
That's the strategic takeaway, I think. It signals a fundamental pivot in immigration philosophy. Prioritizing direct financial contribution is one of the most prized attributes for new residents. It's really shifting away from that historical ideal of the immigrant primarily as a source of labor or ideas and towards the immigrant as a source of capital.
Which is, I mean, that's a tectonic shift in underlying U.S. values, isn't it?
It really is. Okay, so moving now from foreign policy and this sort of monetized immigration, let's turn to the domestic sphere. Because the executive branch was simultaneously directing the tools of the national security state inward against domestic political movements.
Hmm.
Right. This revolves around the formal designation of Antifa as a domestic terrorist organization.
Yeah.
The executive order itself builds on previous statements, describes the movement as a militarist anarchist enterprise that explicitly calls for the overthrow of the U.S. government. That's the language used.
Now, the designation itself is obviously highly politicized, but it's the operational mechanism that really gives it teeth, isn't it?
Exactly. It wasn't just a statement. This designation was immediately operationalized through something called National Security Presidential Memorandum 7, NSPM 7. The title is Countering Domestic Terrorism and Organized Political Violence.
Okay, NSPM 7, what does that actually do?
NSPM 7 is the functional heart of this whole bureaucratic lever. It directs the Attorney General to prioritize domestic terrorism investigations, and critically, it expands the remit of federal agencies involved. It tasks the Joint Terrorism Task Forces, the JTTFs.
Which usually focus on foreign threats, right? Like ISIS or Al-Qaeda.
Precisely. It tasks the JTTFs and the Treasury's Financial Intelligence Office, FinCEN, to investigate not just physical violent acts, but also the institutional and individual funders and organizations that sponsor or otherwise aid and abet these targeted movements, like Antifa.
Okay, investigating the funders, the implication there for civil liberties seems profound.
It's huge. This isn't just rhetoric. By designating a domestic group as a terrorist entity, the administration basically unlocks the powerful surveillance and financial tracking tools of the national security apparatus against them.
Tools like what?
Enhanced wiretapping authority, easier access to bank records under anti-money laundering statutes, financial tracking mechanisms usually reserved for foreign hostile actors or terrorist financiers.
So civil liberties groups must have reacted strongly.
Immediately. Raised huge alarms. They argue this framework provides a bureaucratic pretext to investigate the funding structures of domestic political opponents. It effectively leverages, you know, financial laws in it to suppress First Amendment protected activities, things like protests, dissent, even political fundraising.
So the goal might be less about immediate prosecution and more about creating a chilling effect.
That seems to be the core concern. Establishing an official framework for financial investigation based purely on political designation could definitely chill speech and association.
This philosophy of executive-led control, it also extends pretty deeply into the economic realm, doesn't it? Specifically through this renewed push for economic nationalism using executive fiat, trade powers being flexed again.
Very much so. The administration invokes Section 232 authority again to impose new tariffs.
Section 232, remind us what that is.
Sure, it's an old Cold War era statute. It lets the president impose tariffs on imports if the Commerce Department finds that those imports threaten U.S. national security. It's highly discretionary power.
And the administration has used it aggressively before. What did they target this time?
This time, they imposed a 10% global tariff on importing softwood lumber and a 25% global tariff on specific finished wood products.
Which ones?
Upholstered furniture, kitchen cabinets, and vanities. And that furniture tariff, notably, is set to increase even further in the new year.
So the administration is essentially defining imported sofas and kitchen cabinets as a threat to national security, to protect domestic manufacturers.
That's the mechanism, yes.
Right.
Protecting targeted domestic manufacturing industries using the national security justification provided by Section 232.
And beyond these unilateral tariffs, there was also movement on trade with Japan.
Yes, they formalized a new framework trade agreement with Japan. This agreement establishes a baseline 15% tariff on nearly all Japanese imports.
Nearly all, but with exceptions.
Right. And the exceptions show this very transactional, selective approach to trade management. They carved out specific exemptions for things like natural resources the U.S. doesn't have, and also generic pharmaceuticals.
So it's not blanket protectionism, it's more surgical, sector by sector.
Exactly. Surgical sector-by-sector negotiation, focused on forcing specific supply chain changes or protecting specific industries rather than just walling everything off.
We also saw some movement on the TikTok situation finally.
Yes. An executive order came out declaring that a proposed spin-off deal seems to satisfy the outstanding national security concerns.
Which deal is this?
The one involving a joint venture. U.S. investors like Oracle, Silver Lake Partners taking a majority stake, but the Chinese parent company, ByteDance, retaining a non-controlling minority stake. The EO declared this structure acceptable and gave the parties 120 days to finalize the complex sale and divestiture process.
Okay, so putting all these actions together, the Section 232 tariffs, the Japan deal, the TikTok resolution, it really solidifies this managed trade doctrine, doesn't it?
Absolutely. It's a formal rejection of that old multilateral free trade model. In its place, you have highly bilateral transactional management, using tariffs and national security claims as aggressive levers to protect domestic industries and, in TikTok's case, force the restructuring or outright sale of foreign-owned assets operating here.
And then finally, within the purely administrative domain, we saw two very different executive orders that kind of reflect this intent to control both the substance and the aesthetics of the bureaucracy.
Yeah, two interesting ones. First, a technical but actually pretty vital order came down on September 29th. It ensured the continuance of over 20 federal advisory committees, pushed their expiration date out to September 30, 2027.
Why is that important? What do these committees do?
They're also composed of outside experts, academics, industry figures. They advise federal agencies on everything from scientific standards to complex national security threats. Normally, many would lapse automatically at the end of the fiscal year without action. So this order is a quiet but powerful exercise of authority. It ensures continued executive influence over these expert bodies.
Keeping them going under the current administration's oversight.
Exactly. And then there was the much more symbolic but highly visible aesthetic intervention.
Ah, the architecture order.
Right, an executive order establishing classical architecture as the preferred and default architecture for federal public buildings.
So, mandating a specific style, like Greek columns and domes.
Essentially, yes. It's an overt rejection of modernist or other contemporary designs, an insistence on a traditionalist style for all new federal buildings. You can see it as a kind of soft power move, trying to align the physical look of federal power, the courthouses, the embassies, agency headquarters, with a very specific traditional vision of American governance.
Okay, so that really lays out the executive side of this dissonance. Rapid, aggressive governing, mostly using unilateral power. Now let's turn to the counterpoint, the legislative branch. which in stark contrast seemed consumed by crisis and just paralyzed by infighting.
Completely paralyzed.
Yeah.
The whole legislative story of these 48 hours was defined by that looming midnight September 30th government funding deadline. Congressional leaders had this late-day White House meeting on the 29th and failed spectacularly to reach any kind of deal.
Just walked away with nothing.
Pretty much. The two sides are just fundamentally entrenched in their positions, each trying to squeeze maximum leverage out of the situation.
Okay, break down the positions. What does the Republican side want?
The Republican position is relatively straightforward.
Yeah.
They're insisting the Senate pass the Clean Continuing Resolution, the CR, that the House already approved. This CR would just extend funding for 7 weeks, kick the can down the road to November 21st. And it includes a specific pot of money for security enhancements. They want a short-term, no-strings-attached funding fix.
But Democrats aren't going for a clean bill.
Absolutely not. They're refusing to budge unless Republicans meet two critical demands. One, Republicans must immediately agree to extend the expiring Affordable Care Act premium tax credits. Those are crucial health care subsidies for millions. And two, they need assurance against executive rescissions or impoundments, basically. A promise the White House won't just refuse to spend money Congress appropriates.
And the Democratic base is pushing for this hard line.
Yeah, there's a lot of pressure on leadership not to cave like they might have in past funding fights. So they're digging in.
But the truly radical development in this shutdown crisis, it didn't actually come from Congress, did it? It came from the White House Budget Office.
That's right. The Office of Management and Budget, OMB. They issued this directive instructing agencies on how to prepare for a shutdown, and it contained an unprecedented shift. They were told to prepare for a reduction in force, a RIF.
A RIF reduction in force? That sounds much worse than a furlough. What's the difference?
It is much worse. This is the definitive difference between this looming shutdown and basically every shutdown in the modern era. Historically, a funding lapse meant a temporary furlough. Employees sent home. They kept their status, their benefits, and crucially, they had a legal entitlement to get back pay once Congress eventually funded the government.
Okay, so furloughs were temporary, with back pay guaranteed.
Right. The OMB memo explicitly overturns that precedent. It reframes a lapse in funding not as a temporary pause, but as potential justification for termination. Actual permanent layoffs.
Permanent layoffs. Wow. The legal and psychological impact of that must be immense for federal workers.
Oh, it's huge. RIF means you lose your job, your federal status gone, and you're legally barred from receiving back pay, unlike someone on furlough. It transforms the uncertainty of a shutdown, which is bad enough, into the potential certainty of mass unemployment. It creates this state of, frankly, existential terror across the federal workforce.
And were there specific criteria for who would face these RIFs, or was it across the board?
No, the criteria were highly politicized, seemingly designed not for efficiency, but for achieving policy goals. Agencies were instructed to target employees whose programs met specific conditions, funded by discretionary appropriations, no other funding source available. And the most critical part, programs deemed not consistent with the president's priorities.
Not consistent with the president's priorities. So this isn't about saving money, it's about policy.
It appears to be a devastating bureaucratic strategy. It transforms the annual need to fund the government into a tool for the executive, a tool to unilaterally dismantle programs it opposes, structurally shrink the administrative state, all without needing to pass a single law through Congress. It completely bypasses the legislative process.
Just leveraging congressional gridlock to achieve executive goals by default.
Precisely. And we're already seeing the potential agency-specific impacts being projected. They're devastating. The Department of Defense, for instance, huge civilian workforce. Their contingency plans project that 45% of their civilian employees.
45%? How many people is that?
That's 334,900 employees, facing furlough initially, but under these new rules, potentially facing RIF's permanent layoffs.
330,000 people just at DOD.
Yeah, and Defense classified only about 30% of their civilians as accepted personnel, meaning their work has to continue protecting life, property, supporting military ops, key intel functions.
So even critical functions could be impacted.
Well, their top priorities, like maintaining the Golden Dome for America, missile defense system, ongoing Middle East operations, those would continue only if the funding for them had already been legally obligated before the deadline. It limits their ability to start anything new or react flexibly.
Okay, so DOD is bracing for massive cuts. What about other agencies? Any different approaches?
Interestingly, yes. The Internal Revenue Service, the IRS, seems to be operating on an entirely different playbook. It shows how agencies are trying to find ways around this chaos. They updated their shutdown plan to keep all employees working for 5 business days after a funding lapse.
All IRS employees, how can they do that without appropriations?
It's thanks to the multi-year modernization funds provided by the Inflation Reduction Act, the IRA.
The IRA funding. That's ironic, isn't it? Given the administration's stance on the IRA.
Deeply ironic. The administration has historically opposed the IRA, but now it's heavily reliant on those very funds to keep the IRS a critical federal function, collecting revenue running during a potential shutdown. This reliance comes even after the IRS has already lost over 8,600 taxpayer services employees through voluntary buyouts and workforce reductions tied to the administration's own efficiency goals.
So they're using IRA funds to keep the lights on, even as the overall workforce shrinks.
Exactly. It means nearly 75,000 IRS employees could keep working initially, ensuring tax processing and revenue collection continues, at least for a week.
And amidst all this chaos, this looming shutdown, this RIF threat,
yeah.
Did regular congressional work just stop?
Amazingly, no. Despite this massive impending crisis, the specialized work of Congress just kept chugging along on September 30th. Committees were still holding hearings, briefings. The Judiciary Committee planned a hearing on specific crime policies. Armed Services had a closed briefing on that Golden Dome missile defense system. And the Homeland Security Committee was set to examine the weaponization of the Quiet Skies program.
Okay, we need to unpack that last one. Quiet Skies program. What is that, and why is its weaponization a concern for Congress?
Right. The Quiet Skies program is a highly sensitive surveillance initiative run by the TSA, the Transportation Security Administration. It involves monitoring certain airline travelers. These aren't people on the formal no-fly list or even the main watch list. They're individuals deemed to potentially higher risk based on behavioral indicators or travel patterns, things like that. Supposedly related to counterterrorism.
Okay, so it's monitoring people not officially on watch lists. Why the weaponization concern?
The concern centers on alleged misuse. The fear is that this program, designed for counterterrorism, could be used or weaponized to surveil political proponents, journalists, domestic dissidents. People the government disagrees with, essentially. If that were happening, it would represent a massive breach of civil liberties and a misuse of the agency's mandate, hence the committee investigation.
Okay, so this fundamental clash, aggressive, executive, paralyzed legislature, it naturally pushes these huge constitutional questions straight into the judicial arena, doesn't it? The Supreme Court is rapidly becoming the main battlefield for redrawing the lines of presidential power.
Absolutely. And we saw a direct challenge on September 29th to a real cornerstone of U.S. citizenship. The administration formally petitioned the Supreme Court, asking them to rule on the legality of its executive order aimed at ending birthright citizenship.
Ending birthright citizenship via executive order. They want the court to overturn the established interpretation of the 14th Amendment.
That's exactly what they're asking. To overturn over a century of precedent based on the Wong Kim Ark decision, they're arguing that the longstanding interpretation that birth on U.S. soil automatically confers citizenship is, quote, mistaken and has had destructive consequences on the country.
So this isn't just a policy argument. They're seeking a landmark judicial ruling to validate a really expansive view of executive power over what most see as established constitutional law.
Precisely. And the administration had actually already secured a massive victory on presidential power just days earlier on September 26th, related to the power over the purse.
What was that ruling?
The Supreme Court issued a stay. It blocked a lower court order that had required the White House to spend nearly $4 billion in foreign aid funds, funds Congress had appropriated, but the administration was just withholding, the practice known as impoundment.
Okay, so the lower court said spend the money, but the Supreme Court stopped that order.
Yes, and because those specific funds were set to expire at the end of the fiscal year, September 30th, the court's stay effectively ensured the money was never spent. It lapsed.
Wow. That ruling seems huge then. It effectively ratified the executive's power to withhold funds impoundment over Congress's constitutional power of the purse.
In this specific instance, yes. It significantly shifted the balance in appropriations disputes, definitely in favor of the White House, by allowing the clock to run out on the funds. A major win for executive power over spending.
But not all the judicial news went the executive's way. There was a check on trade power, too.
That's right. A check came down from the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. They affirmed a lower court ruling that actually invalidated a series of tariffs the president had imposed.
Which tariffs were these? Under what authority?
These were tariffs imposed under IEPA, the International Emergency Economic Powers Act. Now, for listeners, IEPA is a really powerful law. It grants the president sweeping authority to regulate international commerce during a declared national emergency.
So what did the Federal Circuit say was wrong with using IEPA for these tariffs?
Their ruling was quite specific. They found that the president's authority under IEPA to regulate imports, well, it didn't extend to imposing tariffs of unlimited duration on nearly all goods entering the country from certain places. The court basically drew a line. They said IEPA is designed for more targeted, temporary emergency economic actions, not for broad, permanent economic policy changes that start to look a lot like Congress's taxation authority.
So the courts are pushing back on some fronts, but validating executive power on others.
Exactly. These rulings just perfectly confirm that strategic dynamic we talked about. The administration pushes the outer limits of legal boundaries with aggressive executive action, and the courts become the final stop, deciding case by case whether those boundaries hold or if they crumble under the pressure.
Okay, let's shift focus slightly now to the actual machinery of government, the functional side, behind the scenes. We're seeing both ongoing tech threats and some critical, maybe long overdue, modernization efforts.
Yeah, let's start with cybersecurity, because email continues to be a huge vulnerability. On September 29th, there was this incident involving hackers, believed to be APT-41 actors. That's a sophisticated state-linked group, likely China. They successfully impersonated Representative John Woolinar in a phishing email.
Impersonated a congressman. Who did they target?
Powerful trade groups, DC law firms, right ahead of some sensitive U.S.-China trade talks.
And how did the phishing work? What was the lure?
This is what's terrifying, the social engineering aspect. The email contained what looked like a high-level draft proposal related to the trade talks, and it explicitly solicited personal input from the recipients. It played on ego, you
know? Yeah.
Flattering them with direct communication from a political official seeking their expertise. The goal was clearly to gain trust and extract sensitive strategic information or install malware.
And this incident just highlights how outdated federal email security policies are.
Desperately outdated. The main federal policy, it's called Binding Operational Directive 1801, or BOD 1801. It relies on standards like SBF, DKIM, DMIRC technical stuff to verify senders. But that policy hasn't been significantly updated since 2018. And in the age of AI-enhanced social engineering attacks, these old methods that just check signatures and domains, they're considered totally insufficient.
So what are the experts recommending?
Urgently recommending agencies leverage modern tools, specifically integrating AI to pre-scan emails, looking for these highly sophisticated social engineering tactics, analyzing behavioral patterns, things simple checks miss. They argue this needs to be woven into existing security frameworks, like the Zero Trust strategy mandated under Executive Order M2209. Zero Trust requires constant verification for every user, every device, trying to access resources. Email needs that level of scrutiny now, too.
Okay, so cyber threats remain acute. But simultaneously, the Treasury Department is pushing ahead with a massive operational modernization project.
Yes, focused on payments, set to be effective October 1st, 2025, so right after the period we're covering. The core goal is efficiency. Move to 100% electronic payments. Eliminate paper checks entirely.
Why the big push now? What are the benefits?
Well, the financial rationale is pretty undeniable. It costs Treasury over $3 to print, process, and mail a single paper check. Compare that to only about 15 cents for an electronic ACH payment.
Huge savings per transaction.
Massive. Plus, this move is crucial to combating the explosion in check fraud we've seen since 2021. Millions of Treasury checks, tax refunds, Social Security payments, stimulus, they're prime targets for theft and forgery. Going electronic cuts that off.
But doesn't moving everything to faster electronic payments create new risks, especially with real-time payments?
Yes. That's the critical tension. The push for speed, especially if Treasury fully adopts real-time payment rails like FedNow or the private sector's RTP network, it introduces a major vulnerability. Instant settlement means payments are irreversible. Once the money's sent, it's gone. And that dramatically speeds up a specific type of crime called authorized push payment fraud, or APP fraud.
Authorized push payment fraud, how does that work?
It's where a fraudster tricks you, the legitimate account holder, into authorizing a payment to an account they control. Maybe they impersonate the IRS or a relative needing help. Because the payment is instant and irreversible, once you push that button, the money is gone.
And the U.S. system makes this easier.
Yes. Because of a fundamental flaw in our banking infrastructure compared to some other countries, our system primarily verifies only the account number and the routing number. It does not routinely verify the name of the recipient attached to that account.
So you could think you're paying John Smith, but if the account number belongs to a scammer, the money goes to the scammer, even if the name doesn't match.
Exactly. The system doesn't flag the name mismatch before the instant payment goes through. This is why experts are screaming for a critical safeguard that's used successfully overseas. The UK, for example, uses a system called Confirmation of Payee, or COP. It verifies the recipient's name against the account name before the instant payment is executed. It gives you a warning if they don't match.
So implementing something like COP is essential for the U.S. government to move to these irreversible real-time payments safely.
Absolutely essential. Otherwise, you risk facilitating a massive new wave of authorized push payment fraud against the very people receiving government benefits or tax refunds.
Okay, finally, let's look at the human side of the federal workforce itself during this period. The stress, the challenges, but also some signs of innovation and care?
Right. On September 29th, the American Federation of Government Employees, AFGE Local 4070, announced a really critical new initiative. It's aimed at addressing the tragically high suicide rates among federal correctional officers.
That's a devastating statistic, isn't it? How bad is it?
It's horrific. Federal correctional officers are 7 times more likely than the general public to die by suicide. 7 times. It speaks volumes about the immense stress, the trauma, the isolation of that job.
So what is the union doing?
This local union, they're partnering with an organization called the Gray Matters Collective, and they're taking immediate practical action. They're funding specialized suicide prevention training for 24 staff members at Thompson Prison in Illinois. And they're putting up visible resources signs with the 908 crisis line number, magnets with mental health warm lines prominently throughout the facility, making help accessible.
And is there buy-in from management?
Encouragingly, yes. The relatively new director of the Federal Bureau of Prisons has also stated a focus on staff mental health. So there's hope this kind of union-led, coalition-based effort could potentially be expanded nationwide. It's desperately needed.
Definitely. And lastly, on the operational side, the Census Bureau is looking ahead, planning for 2030.
Yes, already deep into planning for the 2030 census. They announced they'll be conducting field tests next year, in 2026, across 6 really diverse sites, urban areas in Texas, tribal lands in Arizona, growing areas in Colorado, rural spots in North Carolina, South Carolina, and Alabama.
What are they testing? New methods?
Trying to improve methods, yes. Especially for better counting historically undercounted populations. And one novel method they're going to test?
What's that?
Using U.S. postal workers as census takers in at least 2 of those locations.
Postal workers? What's the thinking there?
The rationale is pretty clear. Leverage postal workers' intimate, granular knowledge of the neighborhoods they serve every day. They know the streets, the housing units, maybe better than anyone. The hope is that local knowledge improves counts, especially in hard-to-reach communities.
Hasn't this idea been controversial before?
Oh,
because of cost.
It has. The Government Accountability Office, the GAO, has questioned this strategy in the past, mainly due to the significantly higher pay rates for USPS workers compared to temporary census takers. Mail carriers are unionized, earning around $41 an hour, according to past reports, whereas temporary census taker pay was closer to $15 an hour back in 2011. So it's much more expensive.
So the Bureau is prioritizing potential accuracy gains over cost efficiency here.
It seems so. At least for this test phase in specific areas, they're clearly willing to explore whether that neighborhood expertise translates into better data, even if it costs more per enumerator hour.
Okay, so let's try to synthesize this incredibly packed 48-hour period. That core dynamic we identified, strategic dissonance, it's not just holding, it feels like it's accelerating, doesn't it?
Absolutely accelerating. You have the executive branch governing aggressively, almost entirely via executive fiat. The threat of RAFs, that comprehensive Gaza plan dropped like a bomb, the huge H-1B fee imposition, and crucially, exploiting the legislative crisis, the shutdown threat, to achieve fundamental structural changes that bypass Congress.
And this whole approach is just forcing the judicial branch to step in and actively redraw the boundaries of presidential power, ruling by ruling. We saw them validate executive power with that impoundment stay, letting billions in aid lapse. But we also saw a clear check on power with that IEEPA tariff ruling.
While Congress, meanwhile, remains utterly paralyzed, just enabling this transformation through inaction.
So this period, these 48 hours, it feels like it marks a really fundamental rapid change in how the U.S. government functions, moving quickly toward a system that feels more monetized, look at the immigration changes, more executive-led, and maybe more politically weaponized, using administrative tools for political ends.
You know, politically weaponized administrative state where, you know, capital seems prioritized in immigration, and financial tools are being deployed for domestic political control or influence.
So if we project this forward, the administration is driving structural changes that are going to be really hard to reverse, aren't they? I mean, think about the inevitable mass firings if that OMB RIF directive is actually carried out during a shutdown. Combine that with the, 100,000 voluntary departures already anticipated from that deferred resignation program.
Right. It raises this really chilling question about the future stability and competence of government itself.
What happens? What happens to the essential expertise, the institutional memory, the ideal of political neutrality within the federal administrative state, when its actual size and its fundamental purpose are being structurally redefined on the fly like this?
Yeah, redefined with such aggression and with so little legislative input or consensus, that's the profound structural risk that's just left hanging in the balance as we close out this deep dive. What kind of government emerges from this?